Chapter 5. I sat at home all the afternoon and tried to do something, but nothing has come of it. For an hour already, I have been roaming aimlessly through the streets. In the course of my patrolling, I go past the new restaurant, the Holländische Diele. This is the third gin shop to go up within the last 3 weeks. These things with their gay placards are springing up like mushrooms everywhere among the houses. The Holländische Diele is the largest and flashiest. Before the illuminated glass door stands a porter, looking like a cross between a bishop and a colonel of the hussars, an enormous fellow with a gilded baton in his hand. I catch his eye. Suddenly, his dignity deserts him, and he prods me in the stomach with his club and grins.
"Hullo, Ernst, you old scarecrow. Comment ça va?" the Frenchman says.
It is Corporal Anton Demuth, sometime our sergeant cook. I salute smartly. In the army, we were always being told that salutes should be given to the uniform, not to the wearer. But this trick uniform here is very high class indeed. It calls for a bow at the least.
"Hello, Anton," I laugh. "But to get down to business, have you got anything to eat?"
"Bet your life," he answers affirmatively.
"Franz Elstermann. Remember Franz? He's here in this syrup shop too. He's the cook."
"And what time did you say I should call?" I ask, for that in itself is sufficient recommendation. Elstermann and Demuth were the prize scroungers of all France.
"Sometime after 1 tonight, says Anton, giving me a wink. "We've just scored a dozen or so geese off a food office inspector. Hush goods, you know. You can bet your life Elstermann will amputate a few of them first. After all, who's to say geese don't have wars where they might lose a leg or so, eh?"
"Nobody," I say.
"Get much business here?"
"Packed to the doors every night. Take a look in."
He pulls the curtain a little to one side, and through a chink I peer into the room. Soft, warm light over the tables, long trailers of bluish cigar smoke floating through it, carpets glowing, shining porcelain, gleaming silver. Women seated at the tables, surrounded by waiters, and beside them, men who do not appear to be sweating in the least, nor are they even embarrassed. With what wonderful self-possession they give their orders.
"Well, my lad, how would you like to have one of them on the switchback, eh?"
asks Anton, prodding me again in the ribs. I do not answer. This rich, colorful glimpse of life touches me strangely. There is something almost unreal in it, as if I only dreamed that I stood here on the dark street in the slushing snow and saw through the chink of a door this strange scene. It enchants me. Though, of course, it is nothing, merely a few profiteers disgorging their money. But we lay too long out there in filthy holes under the ground not to feel sometimes a passionate, almost insane craving for luxury and elegance shoot up in us. For does not luxury mean to be sheltered, to be cared for? And that is the one thing we have had no knowledge of.
"Well, lad, what do you think?" asks Anton again. "Nice, soft little pussies to go to bed with, what?"
I feel it is rather foolish, but at the moment I cannot think what to say. All this talk I have been using for years suddenly seems to me crude and repulsive. Fortunately, Anton now has to resume his poise and dignity. A car is coming. A slim creature steps out and goes in through the door. She is stooping forward a little. She holds her fur to her breast with one hand, and her hair shows gleaming under a close-fitting golden toque. Her knees close together, little feet and a small face. With light, springy ankles, she trips by me, wafting a faint, bitter smell, and I am filled with a wild desire to be able to go in with this lovely creature through the revolving doors, into the tables there, into that pampered, prosperous atmosphere of color and light, and so to saunter on through a benign, carefree existence, surrounded by waiters and servants, well wrapped in a protective, insulating layer of wealth, rid forever of all the poverty and filth that for years have been our daily portion. I suppose I look rather schoolboyish, for suddenly Antone looses a peal of laughter from under his beard, and with a sly look and another prod, he says, "Though they go in silks and satins, in bed they're all the same." "Naturally," I say, and follow up with a smutty joke so that he won't understand me. "Till 1 o'clock then, Antone." "Why not?" he responds solemnly. "Or bonsoir, as the Frenchman says." I wander on, my hands thrust deep into my pockets. The snow mashes under my shoes. I kick it off angrily. What could I do anyway, even supposing I might dine with a woman like that? I should only be able to stare at her, that's all. I couldn't even eat without getting into a mess. And how difficult, I think to myself, how difficult to pass a whole day with such a being. Always on the watch, always on the alert. And then at night, I wouldn't have even the faintest notion how to begin. Not that I am altogether ignorant of women, of course, but what I do know I learned from Jupp and from Valentine. With such ladies as these, that would clearly never do. June 1917 was the first time I was with a woman. Our company was back resting in the huts at the time. It was midday, and we were fooling about in the meadow with a couple of dogs that had run up to us. With flying ears and glistening coats, the beasts would go bounding through the tall summer grasses, and the sky was blue and the war far away. Then Jupp came trotting across from the orderly room. The dogs ran toward him and jumped up on him, but he shook them off and called out, "An order's just come through. We're to hop over tonight." We knew all that that meant. Day after day, the rumble of the drum fire of the big offensive had come rolling back to us off the western horizon. Day after day, we had seen the spent regiments returning, and if we asked any man what it was like, he would merely respond with a gesture and continue to stare straight ahead. Day after day, truckloads of wounded had been streaming past, and day after day, today for tomorrow, we had been digging long ditches for graves. We got up. Baitka and Vesling went to their packs for writing paper. Vili and Tjaden walked over to the cookhouse, and Franz Wagner and Jupp persuaded me to go with them to the brothel. "Why, Ernst, lad," said Wagner, "you don't mean to say you're never going to know what a woman is. Who can say but we may all be dead before morning? Looks to me as if they've a heap of new artillery up there. It would be just too absurd to die virgin." The field brothel was in a small town, distant about an hour's walk. We got permits, though not without waiting a long time. Other regiments were also going up the line, and there were many that came in haste to snatch whatever of life they might still get. In a small office, we had to give up our permits and unbutton our flies. Then an AMC corporal examined us to see that we were fit, and we received an injection of a few drops of Protargol, while a sergeant major was explaining that the fee was 3 marks, and that on account of the crush, 10 minutes was all the time that could be allowed us. Then we queued up on the stairs. The line moved slowly forward. At the top of the stairs, the doors kept banging, and each time a man would come out. Then, "Next!" would be called. "How many cows are there?" inquired Franz Wagner of a sapper. 3, said he. "But you don't get any choice. It's a lottery.
If your luck's out, then you fall for a grandmother.
Stewing there in the heat and sweat and stinking breath of the famished soldiers on the frowsy staircase, I began to feel sick. I would have been glad to get out of it. My curiosity had gone. But I was afraid the others would make fun of me. So I waited. At last came my turn. The man who had been before me stumbled out, and I stepped into the room. It was low and dark, and reeked so of carbolic and sweat that I thought it strange to see the branches of a lime tree just outside the window, and the sun and wind playing in the fresh green leaves. So withered and used up did everything in the room appear. There was a dish with pink water on a chair, and in the corner a sort of camp bed, on which was spread a torn sheet. The woman was fat and had on a short, transparent chemise. She did not look at me at all, but straightway lay down. Only when I still did not come, did she look up impatiently. Then a flicker of comprehension showed in her spongy face. She perceived that I was still quite young. I simply could not. Horror seized me, and a choking nausea. The woman made a few gestures to rouse me. Gross, repulsive gestures. She tried to pull me to her, and even smiled as she did so, sweetly and coyly, that I should have compassion on her. What was she, after all, but a poor army mattress that must bed 20 and more fellows every day? But I laid down only the money beside her, and went out hastily and down the stairs. Yup gave me a wink. Well, how was it? So-so, I answered like an old hand, and we turned to go. But no, we must first go before the AMC corporal again and make water under his eyes. Then we received a further injection of Protargol. So that is love, thought I dumbly, despairingly, as we packed up our things. So that is the love my books at home were so full of which I had expected so much in the vague dreams of my youth. I rolled up my greatcoat and packed my ground sheet. I received my ammunition, and we marched out. I was silent and sorrowful, and I thought upon it, how now nothing was left me of those high-flying dreams of life and of love, but a rifle, a fat whore, and the dull rumble out there on the skyline, whither we were now slowly marching. Then came darkness, and the trenches, and death. Franz Wagner fell that night, and we lost besides 23 men. Drops of rain fall glittering from the trees. I turn up my collar. I often long for affection even now, for shy words, for warm, generous emotions. I would like to escape the crude monotony of these last years. But what if it actually came to pass? What if all the gentleness and variety of those other days drew around me again? If someone actually did love me, some slim, delicate woman, such as the one there with the golden toque and the slim ankles, how would it be? Even though the ecstasy of some blue, silver night should gather about us, endless, self-forgotten, in darkness, would not the vision of the fat whore come between us at the last moment? Would not the voices of the drill sergeants suddenly shout their obscenities? Would not memory, scraps of talk, army jokes, at once riddle and destroy every decent emotion? In ourselves even now we are still chaste, but our imagination has been debauched without our being aware of it. Before we knew anything of love at all, we were already being lined up and examined for sexual diseases. The breathless wonder, the impetuousness, the night wind, the darkness, the questionings, all those things that were still with us when, as 16-year-old boys, we would race along after Adela and the other girls through the flickering, gaslit wind, these never came back. Though the time was when the woman was not a whore, yet it did not come back. though I believed it might still be otherwise, and though she embraced me and I trembled with desire, yet it did not return. Afterwards, I was always wretched. Unconsciously, I begin to walk faster, breathe deeper. I will have it again. I must have it again. It shall come again, else what reason is there to live? I make my way to Ludwig's. There is still a light in his room. I fling pebbles up at his window, and he comes down and opens the door for me. Up in the room, Georg Rahe is standing in front of Ludwig's case of geological specimens, holding a large rock crystal and making it sparkle. "I'm glad I've seen you after all, Ernst," he smiles. "Just been around at your place. I'm leaving tomorrow." He is in uniform. "But, Georg," I say haltingly, "you don't mean..." "Yes," he nods. "That's it. Going to be a soldier again. It's all fixed. I start tomorrow." "Can you understand that?" I say to Ludwig. "Yes," he answers. "I think I understand. But it won't help him." He turns to Rahe. "You're disillusioned, Georg. That's your trouble. But just think a moment. After all, isn't it only natural? Up at the front there, our nerves were always strained to the utmost. Any minute it might be a matter of life and death. So now, of course, they flap about like sails when the wind has dropped. And for the simple reason that here everything is a matter of small, painful advances." "Exactly," agrees Rahe. "This petty pushing and shoving for grub and for place, with an odd ideal or two thrown in to make weight, just nauseates me. I mean to clear out of it." "Well, if you must do something of that sort, why not join the revolution?" I say. "You might even be war minister." "Bah, this revolution," answers Georg scornfully. "It was made by a bunch of party secretaries with their thumbs in line with the seam of their trousers. They've taken fright again already at the mere thought of their own audacity. Look at the way they are at one another's throats. Social democrats, independents, Spartacists, communists. And in the meantime, the other fellows are quietly potting off what few real brains they have among them, and they don't even see it." "No, Georg," says Ludwig. "That's not it. We made revolution with too little hate. That's the whole fact of the matter. We wanted to be just to everybody from the very jump, and with the result that the whole thing has fizzled out. A revolution must first rage like a bushfire, then afterwards one can start in with the sowing. But we wanted to destroy nothing and yet to start afresh. We hadn't enough strength left to hate. We were so weary and burned up with the war. One can sleep for weariness, even through a bombardment. You know that yourself. But even now it may not be too late to achieve by work what was missed in the assault." "Work," answers Georg contemptuously, and the rock crystal flashes under the lamp. "We can fight, if you like, but not work." "Then we must learn again," says Ludwig quietly, from the corner of his sofa. "We're too demoralized for that," objects Georg. For a while, neither speaks. The wind drones outside the windows. Rahe walks with great strides about Ludwig's little room, and it really does seem as if he doesn't belong here, within these walls of books and quietness and work. His clean-cut, keen features seem to be in place only over field-gray uniform, as though they belonged to trenches and fighting and war. He props his arms on the table and leans over toward Ludwig. The lamplight falls on his shoulder straps, and behind him glitter the quartzes in the collection of stones. "What are we doing here, Ludwig?" he says deliberately. "Look about you. How slack! How helpless it all is. We are a burden to ourselves and to everyone else. Our ideals are bankrupt, our dreams shattered, We just run about in this world of earnest, purposeful people and profit mongers, like so many Don Quixotes let loose in a strange land.
Ludwig looks at him a while.
It's my idea that we're sick, Georg. We have the war in our bones still.
Raha nods.
Yes, and we'll never get it out again.
Don't you believe it,
retorts Ludwig.
Else it will all have been in vain.
Raha crashes his fist down on the table.
It was in vain, Ludwig. That's just what makes me mad. Think what men we were when we marched away in that storm of enthusiasm. It seemed as if a new age had dawned. All the old things, the rotten, the compromising, the partisan, all swept away. We were young then, as men were never young before.
He takes a lump of crystal from Ludwig's stone collection and holds it like a hand grenade. His hands are trembling.
I have been in many dugouts, Ludwig, he goes on. And we were all young men who sat there around one miserable slush lamp, waiting while the barrage raged overhead like an earthquake. We were none of your inexperienced recruits either. We knew well enough what we were waiting for, and we knew what would come. But there was more in those faces down in the gloom there than mere calm, more than good humor, more than just readiness to die. There was the will to another future in those hard, set faces. And it was there when they charged, and still there when they died. We had less to say for ourselves year by year. We shed many things, but that one thing still remained. And now, Ludwig, where is it now? Can't you see how it is perishing in all this pig's wash of order, duty, women, routine, punctuality, and the rest of it that here they call life? No, Ludwig, we lived then. And you tell me 1,000 times that you hate war, yet I still say we lived then. We lived because we were together and because something burned in us that was more than this whole muck heap here.
He is breathing hard.
It must have been for something, Ludwig. When I first heard there was revolution, for one brief moment I thought, now the time will be redeemed. Now the flood will pour back, tearing down the old things, digging new banks for itself. By God, I would have been in it. But the flood broke up into 1,000 runnels. The revolution became a mere scramble for jobs, for big jobs and little jobs. It has trickled away. It has been dammed up. It has been drained off into business, into family and party. But that will not do me. I'm going where comradeship is still to be found.
Ludwig stands up. His brow is flaming. His eyes blaze. He looks Raha in the face.
And why is it, Georg? Why is it? Because we were duped, I tell you. Duped as even yet we hardly realize. Because we were misused. Hideously misused. They told us it was for the fatherland and meant the schemes of annexation of a greedy industry. They told us it was for honor and meant the quarrels and the will to power of a handful of ambitious diplomats and princes. They told us it was for the nation and meant the need for activity on the part of out-of-work generals.
He takes Raha by the shoulders and shakes him.
Can't you see? They stuffed out the word patriotism with all the twaddle of their fine phrases, with their desire for glory, their will to power, their false romanticism, their stupidity, their greed of business, and then paraded it before us as a shining ideal. And we thought they were sounding a bugle, summoning us to a new, a more strenuous, a larger life. Can't you see, man? But we were making war against ourselves without knowing it.
every shot that struck home struck one of us. Can't you see? Then listen, and I will bawl it into your ears. The youth of the world rose up in every land, believing that it was fighting for freedom. And in every land they were duped and misused. In every land they have been shot down. They have exterminated each other. Don't you see now? There is only one fight. The fight against the lie. The half-truth. Compromise. Against the old order. But we let ourselves be taken in by their phrases, and instead of fighting against them, we fought for them. We thought it was for the future. It was against the future. Our future is dead, for the youth is dead that carried it. We are merely the survivors, the ruins. But the other is alive still, the fat, the full, the well-content that lives on fatter and fuller, more contented than ever. And why? Because the dissatisfied, the eager, the storm troops have died for it. But think of it. A generation annihilated. A generation of hope, of faith, of will, strength, ability, so hypnotized that they have shot down one another, though over the whole world they all had the same purpose. His voice breaks. His eyes are full of passion and sobs. We are all standing now. Ludwig, I say, and put my arm about his shoulder. Raha takes up his cap and tosses the stone back into the case. Goodbye, Ludwig. Old comrade. Ludwig stands facing him. His lips are pressed together. His cheekbones stand out. You are going, Georg, he stammers. But I am staying. I'm not giving in yet. Raha looks at him a while. It is hopeless, he says calmly, and adjusts the buckle of his belt. I go with Georg down the stairs. The leaden dawn is already showing through the door. The stone steps re-echo, and we come out into the open as from a dugout. The street is empty and gray. It drags away into the distance. Raha points along it. All one long fire trench, Ernst, he indicates the houses. Dugouts, everyone. The war still goes on, but a dirty, low-down war. Every man against his fellow. We shake hands. I cannot speak. Raha smiles. What's troubling you, Ernst? It's not a war at all out east, you know. Cheer up. We're soldiers still. And this isn't the first time we have parted. I think it's the first time we have really parted, Georg, I say hastily. He stands there a moment longer before me. Then he nods slowly and goes off down the street, spare, calm, without once looking around. And for a space, I still hear the clatter of his steps when he has already disappeared.